You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, January 23rd, 2008, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Rebecca Watson is not with us this evening because she's in Florida getting ready for TAM 5.5. So in her stead, we have two guest rogues joining us this evening. From Astronomy Cast, we have Fraser Kane.
Hi, everyone.
And Pamela Gay.
Hello there.
Guys, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thanks for coming, guys. Great to have you.
Oh, it's our pleasure.
This is quite the week, so I'm sure you're going to get into that, but it was perfect timing.
Yeah, good timing. A lot of wacky astronomy stuff in the news, which of course we'll be getting right to. You guys were recently at the American Astronomical Society. Did I get that right? A meeting in a couple weeks ago?
Down in Austin, Texas. Yeah, the American Astronomical Society.
How was that?
Oh, it was a blast. Fraser and I finally got to meet face to face after doing our podcast for almost a year and a half.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, it was surprisingly uncomfortable to record our podcast in the same room. I was like, you just kind of get into a routine and everything's nice and quiet, and it was quite strange to have all this equipment that we had to work with, and it was pretty funny.
There was much giggling.
Yeah, I can imagine. It was a while before we met Rebecca face-to-face. We did several podcasts before we had a chance to meet her.
Yeah, and almost a year before we recorded our first show face-to-face. So it was a similar kind of experience. We just sort of had this virtual internet relationship going.
And Rebecca never met Perry.
No, Rebecca never met Perry.
But the conference itself was great. It was more work than I was expecting, that's for sure. I was expecting to go and meet and greet and hang out with astronomers and have interesting conversations. But I think I ended up writing about 35 articles in 4 days.
Wow.
What?
So I mostly just was like chained to the press room writing like a fiend. And that was not what I was expecting. But now that I'm now that I know what's happened, I'm going to be a lot more careful next time and pace myself.
And you guys met Phil Plait while you were down there, right?
Phil and I are old face-to-face friends, and it was wonderful to have the three of us together. People talk to us as like a roving swarm because it was the three of us basically instilling new media on everyone around us.
Did you guys notice that you had a lot of listeners there?
That was one of the really cool things.
Yeah, we did a meetup at a local bar in Austin, and we promoted it on our podcast, and Phil mentioned it, and there's a couple of other places. And I think in the end, we had about 60 people show up.
And some of them were college student fans, high school student fans. We had one person telling us about how he shares our show with his high school teacher, and that was just kind of cool to get to meet people face-to-face and then hear about how things are virally spreading. You don't hear that about podcasts very often.
Yeah, when we've met our listeners a couple of times, and it's always a really good time. And first of all, the podcast universe is growing steadily, and we just don't know how it is. We don't know if most of it's word of mouth or if people are finding us on the web or whatever.
Hey, speaking of which, are you guys planning on attending TAM 6?
the pressure to attend TAM 6 is overwhelming. I think that's like every
yield
time
to
I talk
it.
To Phil, that's like the first thing he's. So are you going to come to TAM 6? TAM 6? What about TAM 6?
It's the happening place. I mean,
definitely.
Hey,
yeah.
It's
I know.
In Vegas.
I get it from Derek. I get it from you guys. TAM 6. I'm dreaming about it. So I would love to attend, but there's a.
So I'll take that as a yes. Okay.
Yeah. Excellent.
Check.
See you there.
Let's move on to some news items. First, we have a quick follow-up from last week. We talked about the UFOs over Stephenville, Texas. Well, since we reported that, the U.S. Air Force has made a clarification. Initially said that there was no Air Force activity in the area at that time. And since then, they said, oops, actually there was some training exercises going on. We had some F-16 fighter jets in the air right over Stephenville, so that probably was responsible for this sightings.
Steve, come on. That is so Men in Black, man.
I know.
Why do they always do that? Why don't they just fess up from the first day?
What's the big deal? It probably was a legitimate error. You know, they don't take those kind of things seriously. They didn't figure this was going to be the one report that was going to somehow, you know, go national in the news. And then afterwards it said, oh, crap, we better really check this out and see if that was accurate. Right. And they found out they made a mistake, so they had to fess up. Of course, it totally feeds the conspiracy theorists.
Yeah, it definitely does. And you would think by now, after so many years of the Air Force being responsible for a lot of the UFO phenomenon that is going on in this country and, frankly, governments of other countries, you think they would be better prepared, more on the ball, more on the stick to put down these stories, not let them go rampant for even just a couple days, and let the fever pitch build.
They blew it. They dropped the ball. At least we got the information now, and that was one of the things that we thought it probably was. It was a high flying craft, certainly could have explained the lights that were misinterpreted as a big UFO over Stephenville. But it is unfortunate that it played itself out that way. Fraser and Pamela, so in the astronomy world, is there still any attention being paid to UFOs, or is this something that's really not even paid attention to anymore?
I think we pretty much don't pay attention to it because we're too busy trying to deal with all the asteroid crazies. We have different flying objects to worry about.
Yeah, the asteroid crazies, which we're going to get to in a minute. When we were talking beforehand about what we would discuss on the show, we had already had on our list the next news item, a mystery image of life on Mars. And you guys wanted to talk about this as well. Fraser, can you give us a summary of this story?
Oh, sure. So there is an image that I think was taken by Spirit on the surface of Mars. And I think the image had been around for several
2004.
Months. 2004. Yeah, for a long time. And so somebody had blown up the image and enhanced it and found what looks like, and I got to say, it does look like this. It looks like Bigfoot running across the surface of Mars, you know, peeking from behind a rock outcropping. But if you see it in better context, you see the whole image that Spirit took, you can see it's obviously some knob off the side of a rock. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is Emily Lakdawala from the Planetary Society is great at analyzing planetary images. And so she's come along and found some of the original 3D images of it and built a 3D view of Bigfoot from kind of different points of view. I guess we're calling it Bigfoot now. Maybe that's what NASA will make its official name for the rock. And so you can kind of get a sense that it doesn't quite look like Bigfoot anymore once you see it in three dimensions. But
yeah.
So she ruined it for everyone, is what
you're
saying.
Yeah. But it is amazing. I mean, you watch this kind of stuff on Dig and stumble upon all the social media stuff, how quickly people go crazy about this kind of stuff and seem to lose their minds almost immediately.
Yeah, I mean, and to put this in context, there were people who have been poring over every image looking for this kind of thing. So it's not a coincidence or amazing that they found something that, you know, through pareidolia, again, the mind sort of fitting a visual pattern onto random images or random noise. You know, okay, it looks kind of like a human figure. I didn't see Bigfoot when I initially saw it. I saw a humanoid, you know, sitting
really?
On a rock with its right arm sort of outstretched in an awkward posture, not necessarily walking behind the rock. I guess you can see it either way. It's suggestive, but you're right. It's like the old man in the mountain before that fell down. You look at it from one angle and it's a face of an old man.
That fell down?
It fell down a few years ago.
Yeah, a couple of years ago, Bob.
That stinks.
You change your angle even slightly and it's just a jumble of rocks.
So Steve, what you're saying is this isn't a Bigfoot astronaut? What are you getting at?
This is probably not a Bigfoot astronaut. It's not wearing any helmet or anything, so the atmosphere on Mars is not very hospitable to big feet, I understand.
But the 3D view of it from Spirit shows that it's only about 5 meters away from the rover, and so the object is only about 6 centimeters tall.
Yeah, so it's a tiny, tiny Bigfoot.
Oh, my God.
And it's not like it's standing perpendicular to gravity. It's kind of poking off the side of a rock. So it's, you know, when you take the image and blow it up and rotate it to whatever suits your interest and, you know, whatever Photoshop madness you're going to do, then you end up with a picture that looks like Bigfoot. I'm thinking more like the creature from the Black Lagoon, actually, for me.
Yeah, actually, you're right.
Yeah.
I'm looking at it now.
That's weird because that reminded me. That didn't remind you of the famous Patterson Gimlin film of Bigfoot, that famous one with him strolling through the forest?
Yeah, it has that look to it, too, that one frame that they keep freezing.
Sort of a stride to it, yeah.
One of the quick and dirty ways to know is this really a living object or not is anytime you see something in color that's taken by a spacecraft, well, that isn't a color image that was all taken at once. You have to take an image in red, take an image in blue, take an image in green. And if something's actually moving, those three filters aren't going to line up because the object, the Bigfoot, will have moved between the two filter switches. So since we see it not moving.
And how long apart are they? So how much would it have moved?
Well, if it's strolling along, it could have moved an entire body length between each filter.
Okay.
Wow.
That's a good point.
So it could have even moved out of frame depending on how tight the picture is.
Exactly.
Yeah. I would like to know if anyone consulted Richard Hoagland for his opinion on what this was.
Do we even have to bother? You know, Richard Hoagland, a face on Mars and fame. The conspiracy theorist who thinks that anything out of the ordinary is a big NASA conspiracy to cover up alien civilizations. So I'm sure he'll jump all over this. There was another astronomical pareidolia in the news in the last week. This one on Mercury.
What a week.
The Messenger spacecraft has made its closest approach to Mercury and is sending back a lot of very interesting photographs of Mercury, the closest planet to the sun. And one of those pictures has what, to my eye, has a striking resemblance to Homer Simpson's head on the surface of Mercury. Again, just another result of pareidolia, of fitting this pattern to a recognizable image stored away in your brain. Although not everybody sees it. Bob, you said it didn't pop out at you.
I have a very hard time. I could just see really the top of his head, and most of the commenters on your blog, I think, agreed with me. But pareidolia is in the eye of the beholder, I guess.
Steve, what side of the picture is he on?
So we'll post the picture. It's the middle right of the picture. The two matched craters are in his eyes, and below them is sort of his 5 o'clock shadow in his mouth. You see that now?
No.
Yeah, that's the way pareidolia works. Either it hits you and then it's there or it doesn't.
I see a bunch of penises. I don't see Homer.
Yeah.
Jeez. Jay, you always see that.
Well, don't make me go there, Bob.
You're already there, my friend.
Oh, holy shit, I see it now.
Oh, it just happened, huh?
Yep, it just clicked.
Snapped.
Yep.
No way.
Well, Steve, now you'll never not see it. That's the thing, now you will never not see it.
His ear is that little double crater on the right-hand side?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah, I see it.
Yeah. So, again, I know this is not the best topic for a podcast because it's all audio, but we'll have these pictures all on our website. And this one is on my blog, as well as the picture of Kermit the Frog on Mars, which is one of my favorite astronomical pareidolia pictures.
That's a great one.
But actually, back to Mercury for just a second. Wasn't it true that we only had about 45% of Mercury actually photographed before the Messenger captured these pictures?
Pamela, you want to give us the skinny on it?
We only had, I think you're right, about 45% that had been imaged by spacecraft. But what's cool is there's been a lot of people from the planet Earth who've been trying to do high-speed imaging using telescopes that are pointed a little bit too close to the sun for comfort to do daytime imaging of Mercury. And we had hints at craters, and we weren't entirely sure if we were right or not. And now we have the image to find out if all these years of attempts to image things from the planet Earth were right or not. So this is cool, and there's a lot of people waiting to go, yeah, I found that crater first. So I'm waiting to see the papers that compare the previous images and the new images.
But it's going to take months, right, for astronomers to really analyze all the data that's coming in over a very short period of time, correct?
That's entirely right. Anytime you get new images, expect about a 6-month delay before you start seeing the science papers.
And this is just the preview, though. So this is the first flyby that Messenger's doing of Mercury. It's going to do another one, and then I think it's going to do one more until it finally enters orbit around Mercury. And so you're going to get these flyby where it's doing a gravity assist on the planet to get itself into orbit. And then finally, so each of these, they only last a couple of days when it takes the images inbound, captures whatever hemisphere is visible to the camera, heads back out to space. But when it finally goes into orbit, then it's going to be picture after picture after picture, just like all, you know, the Mars spacecraft.
Now, I've always thought of Mercury, other than the fact that it's, you know, incredibly hot, one of the more boring planets in our solar system. It's a small moon-like planet that's essentially cratered all around. So is there anything still mysterious about Mercury? Are there any big questions that this new information is likely to solve for us?
Well, there's always the question of, are there any areas that are in permanent shadow that might have anything cool lurking in them where there's a completely different temperature? Mm-hmm. There's questions about, has it ever been hit by something so hard that the shock waves carry around the planet, or an impact on one side leads to a hill on the other? It's those sorts of geological, when was this thing creamed by asteroids questions, the when did it cool off and contract such that the surface cracked, dating using different cratering questions. We're going to start to be able to get at its geologic history a lot better and look at what's hiding in the craters that we haven't been able to see before.
Yeah, that's interesting, because there's no atmosphere on Mercury. If anything is in shadow, it would be really, really cold, even though, right next to it in direct sunlight would be incredibly hot. So, like, what are the temperature variations that we could see on the surface of Mercury?
You could be going from hundreds of degrees Fahrenheit positive to a couple hundred degrees negative.
I think it's a 600-degree variation.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Between the hottest and the coldest.
And does that in and of itself cause any interesting geological effect that we know of?
Well, what it can lead to is, say, a comet hit in just the right place at some point in the past. You could still have water ices hiding in some of the craters, even though everywhere else on the surface, water goes straight to gas.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just leads to contradictions, and that's always interesting.
One thing to remember is that sometimes you just never know what they're going to find is going to be interesting. I mean, you think about like Saturn's moon Enceladus. I think when we first looked at it from Earth, no one had any idea how fascinating a moon it is. But now it's probably one of the most interesting places in the Saturn system, with its ice geysers and cracks and who knows what's going on with that moon. So I think once you finally get a spacecraft in orbit around Mercury that can stay there and start answering questions, you don't know what we're going to find out, which is great, which is why we should keep sending these spacecraft.
Yeah, absolutely, which is the thing about observational science, is that you never know what you're going to see. You're not just answering specific known questions. You're just saying, what is out there?
And, well, who knows? Maybe
the surprises.
Maybe Mercury will be like Mars, and we'll find not Bigfoot, but maybe we'll find a Loch Ness monster.
Good point, Bob.
One of the fascinating things to think about is, because you do have these cooler polar regions and you have craters, while we can't put human beings down on the surface of Venus because of the greenhouse effect, we can stick people down on Mercury's poles just as well as we can on the surface of Mars. And perhaps someday that's just another little world we can explore along with the moon.
Would it be really difficult to get there? Because until you are in the shadow of Mercury, wouldn't you have to get pretty close to the sun? And wouldn't that be prohibitively hot? Is that a technological barrier to our current, say, state of spacefaring technology?
It's something that we'd have a lot of trouble doing now. But unlike Venus, where there's just nowhere to land, I think we can figure out how to overcome the difficulties in getting there. We can use different shadowing. All you have to do is have a shield out in front of your spacecraft. Mm-hmm. This is technology like they're planning to use with the James Webb Space Telescope to keep it cool. You shadow something, and because there's no air to conduct the heat, once you have that shield in place, the rest of your vessels can stay cool. So if we can get there and we can land in the right place, which is always a challenge, NASA has found, there's places cool enough that we just need to worry about the radiation, which is another large problem.
Mm-hmm.
Pamela, question. If I'm standing on the surface of Mercury, how large does the sun look in the sky?
Oh, that's not a number I have straight in my head, but it would be large enough to scare you. I suspect it would be large enough that sunspots would appear larger than the planet Jupiter does in our sky.
Oof.
Wow. So yet another astronomy news item this week, and as Fraser alluded to before,
what a week!
So there's a lot of nonsense going around about asteroid 2007 TU24. Fraser, why don't you tell us about that?
Well, okay, so asteroid, we've known a bit about this one, asteroid 2007 TU24, and people had known that it was going to be making a fairly close pass with the Earth. I think it's 1.4 lunar diameters. Mm-hmm. And the news of this kind of came up around the same time that the Mars, that people had found out that there was going to be an asteroid that had a chance of striking Mars later in January. And that has, they've since rerun the numbers, and that's not going to be a hit. But, you know, when you're comparing, when people are listening to an asteroid hitting Mars, maybe they sort of forgot about the news about an asteroid that's going to fly past the Earth. But now with the Mars one out of the way, now people are looking back at the one that's going to come past the Earth. And so, but what happened was someone posted a video on YouTube that just went right over the top about what was going to happen with this asteroid and sort of all the common scare tactics that it's, that NASA's covering it up, that it could cause untold damage and devastation to the Earth. And then brought in some interesting alternative theories of science, which is the plasma universe, which that lightning bolts would be shooting off of the asteroid and striking the Earth and causing additional damage. So it wouldn't necessarily be that it was going to hit the Earth, but that it was going to actually zap us from afar or cause damage by its close passing. But, I mean, the thing is, we have these kinds of near misses from asteroids all the time. 1.4 Earth radii is pretty close, but, you know, that can happen. And it's happened in the past. It'll happen again. And the nice thing about this is it gives people a chance to go out with their small telescopes. If they know where to look at the right time to look, they'll be able to actually watch the asteroid pass by through the sky.
How big is this one?
Oh, I think it's 300 meters.
Right. Hmm. So that would be pretty devastating if it did hit.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, people estimate that the Tunguska impact, which is the one that flattened Siberian forests back in 1908, was probably, I've heard anywhere from 30 to 100 meters across. Mm-hmm. And so it was, it hit the atmosphere, detonated. So it didn't actually strike the ground and knock down the trees for several thousand square kilometers. So an asteroid larger than that would definitely strike the Earth and cause damage on a local scale. You know, you'd merely take out a goodly portion of a big city.
Take out a city? So like a city buster?
Yeah, more than that, though. I mean, Tunguska would have made people in a city quite unhappy. So more than that. But not like, you know, ending humanity and global, right. You know, global catastrophe. This would just be a very bad day for a good chunk of the Earth.
Well, they recently downgraded the size of the Tunguska incident, the asteroid or comet. I think they realized that it was a little smaller than they thought, which means that a small object can be more devastating than they anticipated.
Yeah, I read about that. There was some new simulations were done in supercomputer where they modeled the way the blast came down from the Tunguska impact, and it came down in a sort of a column. And based on that, they thought that maybe it could even be a smaller one. So, like I said, I've heard estimates from 30 meters all the way up to 100 meters, depending. I mean, what if it's metal? Right. What if it's rock? What if it was comet? Depends on the speed, the angle of impact. Yep. There's a lot of different ways that it could change the amount of damage that it does.
But this object is going to be about 10 Earth radiuses away from us. So it's going to miss us by a lot. And in fact, if it wasn't for everyone out there looking for it all the time, a couple hundred years ago, we would never have known about it. It's going to be too faint to see with just the unaided eye. You have to know where it is and have a fairly good-sized telescope to be able to find it.
But it's going to be 80,000. They're predicting 80,000 miles away?
They're down to about 524,000.
Yeah.
524,000, okay.
Sorry, kilometers. 500,000 kilometers.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
So, but the video that's out now is not talking about it striking the Earth. It's just invoking a bunch of made-up fake astronomy and science to say that nasty stuff is going to happen. And Fraser, you mentioned the plasma universe. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, there's a alternate theory of cosmology that people are calling the electric universe. Phil and I actually deal with this quite a lot on our forum, on the Bad Astronomy Universe Today forum. There's a very organized group of people who they're trying to convince people that there's sort of an alternate cosmology that they've worked out, and they're quite organized, and essentially they try and use forums like ours as a marketing tool to try and convince people about their theories. And we've had a lot of dedicated members that have spent months of time debunking their claims and sort of taking apart their arguments piece by piece and asking for numbers and so on. And it almost comes down to a religious discussion. It's it's quite bizarre to see it unfold.
Are these real professional scientists or are these just cranks?
No, they're not. They're cranks. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And but in many cases on our forum we have real professional scientists who are you know, we're so glad that they're perfectly willing to stand the line and tear apart their arguments piece by piece. In many cases, if you look on Dig and if you look in a lot of these social media places, they're really got a coordinated effort to try and subvert these kinds of these open tools as a way to sow doubt about traditional thoughts of cosmology and astronomy. It's quite bizarre. I mean, they're trying to do a sort of a popularism end run around the traditional method how astronomy is done, right? With astronomy, with all the sciences.
Before, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, with all of them, right? You do your work, you gather your observations, you put together your article, you publish it in a journal, it's peer reviewed.
That's hard work, though. That's hard work.
It's hard work, yeah. So, yeah, and it requires, you know, things like math. So, and so in many cases, that, I guess, is very frustrating to them. And so they're trying to just do an end run around it and go with a popularism. It's almost, it feels very similar to almost like the global warming thing. Global warming deniers, where there's an organized movement that's really interested in using every tool and every opportunity they can to sow dissent and use the same arguments and, you know, switch to ad hominems and all kinds of arguments, you know, all of the logical fallacies that you guys talk about, you see them all played over and over and over again. So
it's like intelligent design too. It's a sort of extra scientific, you know, self-organizing body that's bypassing the usual methods of peer review and making their case directly to the public, you know, filled with misinformation and logical fallacies, and behind it all is an ideological agenda.
They're essentially using Universe Today Bad Astronomy Forum as a marketing tool, and that's not what it's for, right?
It's, yeah, it's a free science, soapbox for them.
Yeah, and so we and they don't understand, right? It is not a place for marketing, and if you try and use it for marketing, we will shut you down and kick you out. If you want to use it as a place to learn more about your theories and try and get some real scientists to come here and help you out and help you evaluate them, then you are absolutely welcome. And if we can do anything to help people take their theories to the next level and help work out the math, you know, we've made that offer many, many times, and it always falls flat.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. They're not interested in that at all.
That's right. Yeah. It's not their agenda.
That's just like, honestly, that the other thing this reminds me of is Neil Adams and his hollow earth theories. He was not interested at all in my attempts to sincerely help him understand how to work the scientific process and how to you know, interface with scientists and get attention to his ideas. That these are the things you need to do. He didn't want to do any of them. He just wanted people just to accept his ideas because he's him.
Accept his ideas and overturn all of physics.
Well, yeah, Neil wanted to overturn all of science, basically, anything that got in his way. Well, yeah, I mean, this is the reality these days, you know, having to deal with cranks, which is what I think is actually the best term for these people. They're scientist wannabes that haven't done the work, and I think that's a good way to characterize it. They're making a popularist approach to science rather than doing the academic approach, which exists for a reason. It's so that ideas get put through the meat grinder and have to show some value before people waste their time on them. But they just, you know, they want to make it American Idol for scientific ideas. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
Let's move on. We have a couple more quick news items, then we're going to do some emails. Bob, you sent me this one about bionic eyes.
Yeah, pretty cool. I think this is one of the coolest pictures of 2000, science pictures anyway, for 2008 so far. The one of the guy holding the bionic contact lens, a contact lens with all these circuitry embedded in it. They also were showing pictures of this contact lens in a rabbit eye. And it it looked pretty bizarre. Researchers at the University of Washington were recently showing off this bionic eye, this contact lens that it contains circuits, LEDs, and what they refer to as a powder of electrical components that one day may give people superhuman vision. Now, that's an important point to make, is that this is just a prototype. This is not working. It's not even lighting up. They just basically threw some of these components together onto this contact lens and then tested it and to make sure it was okay in a rabbit eye. And I think they put it in for like 20 minutes and it seemed to tolerate it fine. But parts of this were very interesting. Babak Parviz at the University of Washington, assistant professor of electrical engineering, said that looking through a completed lens, you would see what the display is generating superimposed on the outside world. Other people have speculated that you'd be able to do things with this, like zooming in on distant objects, getting useful facts to pop up on your field of view, surfing the web, and visual aids for vision impaired people, and of course, immersive video games.
So it's like virtual reality goggles and contact lenses. Is that basically it?
Yeah, that's really, and that's a point I wanted to make. After just a couple more points here about some of these details, the components were built from layers of metal, about only a few nanometers thick, so it's pretty thin stuff. The LEDs were also very tiny, only like a third of a millimeter. And the other electrical components that they referred to as this grayish powder that they sprinkled on the plastic, they took advantage of self-assembly for these components to kind of come together and form the structures that they needed. And that was a very, very interesting application of that technology. And then some people would, of course, at this point will say, well, how do you power this thing? And they're even anticipating how it might be powered. Some were saying that perhaps some sort of solar cells. Or I think they actually embedded in the contact lens a tiny antenna that could potentially collect radio frequency waves and turn them into useful energy. So it was just something that really caught my eye, so to speak. But one problem I have with it, and something that was actually a little bit disappointing, is that for years now I've been anticipating something like this called augmented reality, where essentially you're overlaying computer-generated images over reality for various purposes, but using not contact lenses, but using glasses, which to me that seems such a natural progression to use, you know, using augmented reality, using these glasses. You don't have to worry about putting contact lenses in your eyes or potential adverse reactions to the contact lens. And I thought that's kind of the direction we were going, and that because augmented reality just seems like a no-brainer for me. I mean, that could be your interface. You would no longer need a monitor for a computer. You could use it for things. I mean, just where you would need to overlay on reality something that some computer-generated image, like say a mechanic working on an engine, the schematic of the engine could be overlaid so he could see exactly where everything is. Or a doctor doing an operation, the MRI can be overlaid on the patient. Or just for things like that, I think it would be such a wonderful application of that technology. And it seems like they're jumping the gun, going to this contact lens when it'd be probably cheaper and easier and much more useful to have it use, you know, like glasses that would either project the image onto the lens, or actually project it right onto your retina and just completely bypass, you know, and the middleman and just go right to the retina with a really high resolution image.
Yeah, but you never know how these technologies pan out. You know, you can anticipate what would be the most useful, but you just never know until things actually start to be used by people. So it, you know, never hurts to explore other options.
No, and I'm sure they could actually learn things from this application.
One last quick news item before we do a couple of emails. This is we like to often end on a lighthearted news item. This was incredibly funny. Rebecca blogged about this a couple of days ago. You guys are familiar with the Coast to Coast radio show, Coast to Coast AM. Mm-hmm. It's basically a haven for, you know, any paranormal or conspiracy belief that you could imagine. Originally started by Art Bell. Now it is hosted by a guy named George Norrie. Well, a listener called in claiming that he was a man named Gordon Freeman, that he was a theoretical physicist being stalked by menacing nameless government agents. And Norrie, you know, bought up the story. This is right up his alley, you know, a scientist, you know, working on some secret technology being haunted by the men in black or the government or whatever.
Yeah.
You guys are familiar with this storyline, right?
Well, yeah, I played the game. It's from Half-Life.
Yeah. So the guy was basically laying out the plot of the popular video game Half-Life. And George Norrie ate it up hook, line, and sinker and didn't pick up on the fact that he was being completely punked.
I'm surprised he doesn't have like a team of producers or something. One of them might have picked up on it or something. He just went straight for it, I guess.
I don't think he has a team of producers. You know what's a really funny thing? Years ago when Art Bell was running the show, Perry actually called the show to try to like get one of us on there, and Art Bell was running the whole operation himself. He answered the phone. He was doing everything. And I don't know if that's still the case, or I don't know how big a team is working for it, but I doubt they have a huge, you know, team of people who can do things like that. But it showcases the gullibility of that show, that, you know, whether or not he believed it or not, he certainly just accepted it uncritically, just for the sake of the show.
He loved the idea of the portal. The portal really captured his imagination.
Yeah.
When the guy mentioned the portal, he was like, wow, a portal.
That's
to
awesome.
Other worlds. And then the funny thing was,
wow, a laser gun.
He compared it to the movie Contact, and it didn't seem like it had anything to do with Contact. To me, it seemed like, you know, Stargate. You know, you got this mm-hmm. gate that you could use as a portal. So it's just weird that he thought of the movie Contact, but whatever.
Right.
He wanted it to be the Little Green Men.
Yeah.
Oh, he does. Oh, 5 minutes of listening to that show, you know what he's all about.
He actually has Phil on all the time.
I can only listen to it in 5 minutes.
He has Phil the Bad Astronomer all the time.
Yeah, I guess Phil has been on there.
I think
yeah.
They work it out in advance to keep it in the realm of science. And he's actually quite an enthusiast about space and astronomy, so mm-hmm. works out pretty well. Although they get some pretty goofy calls. It's highly entertaining to listen to it when Phil is a guest.
Is that right?
Oh yeah, because now he's got a real live scientist in the room who can then deal with the crazy questions and call-ins that they get.
Well, let's move on to a few of your emails and questions. The first question, I'm going to do one quick medical question, then I have a couple of physics ones for Fraser and Pamela. But the first one comes from Kent Keller from Omaha, Nebraska, and he writes, I would like to ask you, Dr. Novella, as a neurologist, your opinion of restless leg syndrome. My brother, who is a physician, a dermatologist, told me that his professional colleagues tell him that RLS is a made-up myth, that two major pharmaceutical companies have turned their failed sleep meds into a new need and market. We have all seen the massive TV and print media advertising. I have heard you on a past podcast talk about the natural paralysis. This is necessary for REM sleep to keep us from acting out our dreams. Also, these RLS medications are vasodilators. The effect is relieving the tingling feeling in the legs, which is, I believe, a result from inactivity, a very American thing. Anyway, can you set the story straight on RLS as science or fiction? Thank you for the weekly hour of fresh air on the treadmill for me. Well, this one I could deal with this fairly quickly. Pretty much everything that Kent said in that email is completely wrong. And that is the myth, is what he said, that RLS was invented by pharmaceutical companies to manufacture a market for their drugs. This is just anti-big pharma paranoia, completely made up nonsense. Restless leg syndrome has been known about for a long time, long before anyone had any medications to treat it. This is a sleep disorder in which the legs are restless. They move. And that wakes people up or lightens their sleep, prevents them from getting deep restorative sleep. This has been, you know, diagnosed by sleep studies. I learned about this in medical school. It was going back into like 1990, so going back a long time. So this is nothing new at all. There are two medications that are used to treat this, and they both actually were not invented as sleep aids. That's also wrong. These medications were already FDA approved for the treatment of Parkinson's disease. So they already had a market. They were already on the market. And they were not failed drugs at all. They do what they're supposed to do. They're mainly dopamine agonists or dopamine analogs. And they work on the same part of the brain that is affected by Parkinson's disease, as is also affected in restless leg syndrome. These are both disorders of the basal ganglia, of what we call the extrapyramidal system. So it makes perfect sense that these medications, you know, might help with restless leg syndrome, and they do, and they work really well. So The basic science is there. The condition pre-existed. The market for these medications were already FDA approved, proven drugs that work on the brain and do what they're supposed to do. And this whole paranoia about RLS being made up is just, seriously, it's anti big pharma made up propaganda. So thanks for the opportunity to straighten that out.
Steve, I have a question.
Yes. Yes, my check will be in the mail in about 2 weeks.
I don't know if
we've talked... what's your question?
Have we talked about alien hand syndrome? Is that similar to RLS?
It's not similar to RLS. Alien hand syndrome is the neurological phenomenon when people's like one side, one arm or one hand will sort of move by itself, sort of have a light, take on a life of its own. That is a brain disorder, but it's in a different part of the brain. It's more of a brainstem disorder. And that usually happens as a result of a stroke, for example. So yeah, it's similar in that it's a movement disorder from a lesion in the brain, but it's a different part of the brain. It's a discrete, distinct phenomenon from restless leg syndrome.
I saw that in Evil Dead 2. Very cool.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Good acting.
All right, well, let's get to a couple of physics questions. This one comes from Jesse Yoder. Yoder, who gives his location only as the United States. And Jesse writes, you spent some time discussing the concept of time travel a week or so ago. I didn't really understand most of what you were saying, but I am under the impression that you embrace it as a concept, but it is and will continue to be physically impossible because of a limiting factor. The concept itself has always seemed ludicrous to me, as I see time as more of a naming convention than a measurement of some concrete fabric. I don't understand how you can move through something that exists only as a description of a sequence. I recently had this discussion with someone who talked about traveling greater than the speed of light. We see stars that no longer exist because of their distance from us and the restrictions of the speed of light. So I understand how traveling at greater speeds could alter a person's perspective. How are speed and time related? How could time be different in different places? I don't know anything about black holes or different states of matter. Can you try to explain this again in the simplest possible terms? I still can't buy into this idea, Jesse. Well, that's a very common question. These are very, very abstract concepts that are difficult for humans to wrap our brains around because we did not evolve really the concepts to deal with relativity. However, time is a real thing. It is not just a construct. And I'm sure Pamela can tell us a lot more about it.
Well, it all comes down to this basic idea that Einstein came up with, that everyone sees the speed of light as the exact same speed. So if I'm sitting here in my chair, hanging out on a planet going around the sun, I see a light beam whiz past me, and it has a specific speed, 300,000 kilometers per second. Then if I get in my spaceship and I start zipping off, and compared to the chair I left behind in my office, I'm going at, say, 200,000 kilometers per second. I'm going two-thirds the speed of light compared to my chair.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, going 200,000 kilometers per second, I still see the speed of light as being the same. Now, the only way that is possible is if I either have a very broken way of trying to measure the speed of light, or if my time slows down. So I can measure the speed of light as being the same no matter what if my clock's adjustable. Let's say I use a stopwatch to measure how long it takes light to get from one end of my spaceship to the other. That distance compared to me and the spaceship going along appears to be the same, and so the time has to change in order for me to measure the same speed when I'm traveling that 200,000 kilometers per second, or when I'm sitting still relative to my chair in my office. Did that help?
Yeah, well, that's clear to me, but I understood it ahead of time. But I think that was pretty clear. But I think one of the things that he's hung up on is that he's thinking of time as just conceptual, like a mathematical convenience of just something that we measure. But it is accurate to say that time is an actual physical property of the universe. It's an actual dimension of the universe, correct?
It's built into atoms.
We actually did a show on a question on this where someone asked us a question, would different parts of the universe celebrate the birthday of the universe at different times? And it would, where it just depends on how much a piece of mass a piece of matter has moved since the Big Bang. And so the things that have moved fast would experience the birthday on one day, one time, while things that have moved slower would experience it at a different time. And so every mm-hmm. piece of mass in the universe is experiencing time at a different rate depending on how quickly it's moving.
If you swing your arm around, your arm is in a different time frame than the rest of your body, you know, to a minute and unmeasurable degree, but it's still true.
One of the coolest things I think I've learned is if you take an unstable atomic particle and you accelerate it to an extremely high velocity.
I love unstable atomic particles, by the way. Go ahead.
They're just sexy.
Yeah, oh yeah.
So you take this unstable atomic particle and you fling it at high velocities. Well, in its frame of reference, time's going along, but its clock is now ticking slower than your not flung at high velocities clock is ticking. Mm-hmm. And so you can see this particle exist for longer amounts of time than it is supposed to exist because its clock got slowed down. But if you just stick a pile of this unstable particle beside you, like a lump of dead material, it's just going to decay right there, right now. I'm done. So it's only high-speed unstable particles that are able to hold on to their state of being.
GPS satellites have to take into account relativity to be able to send their signals and know and keep track of time.
GPS wouldn't work.
So it's one of those things that's completely counterintuitive, really hard to wrap your head around.
Right.
But as long as you appreciate the fact that the speed of light is the speed of light, it can never change, then time has to change.
Right.
Now, the satellite, though, is more not so much high velocity, but more the closer you are to a gravitational source. It also affects time in the same way, but it's the idea is still the same.
You have both things, yes.
And as bizarre and counterintuitive as this seems, if you think that this is not correct, then you need to come up with an alternate hypothesis to explain all of the experimental and observational data we have, because everything supports this construction, Einstein's basic theory and general theory of relativity. If you don't agree with it, give us an alternate hypothesis. You know, win the Nobel Prize, but no one's been able to do it.
And just to shamelessly plug AstronomyCast for a second, we did two episodes on this. So we did one episode on special relativity, which is more this realm, and then we also did an episode on general relativity, which is more dealing with just some of the other predictions made by Einstein that people are still trying to prove today. So,
and we're going to do a little bit more right here because we have a second question that is related to this. So let me read that one now. This will be our last email. This one comes from Marius Myberg from South Africa. And they write, on a recent podcast, the podcast of January 02, 2008, you spoke about relativity theory and specifically the relativity of time dilation, and whether or not time travel is theoretically possible. Now, let me start off by saying that I am not a physicist. That might be why I hold the opinion I do. Nonetheless, I have read many books and papers and internet sites on this topic, and I have not yet succeeded in not being skeptical about this theory. It just doesn't make logical sense to me. And the answer, it is just too complex to understand, is of course not acceptable. I am trying to get into contact with Simon Singh so that he can perhaps explain the whole relativity of time issue to me. Can you perhaps on your podcast try to explain the basic concept of time dilation and show how it makes logical sense? Or, if that is not possible, then perhaps admit that we should be more skeptical about these ideas. And in that case, the question is, how come modern science seems to accept these paradoxical ideas so easily? Well, Pamela, there isn't really anything that, we did explain some of this already, but there's nothing that is really paradoxical about this, meaning that relativity is consistent with everything that we've observed so far. There are no unsolved mysteries in this, or am I mistaken?
The only paradox is the one between the reality that we think is true when we're little kids and the reality we find out is true when we take relativity class.
Right.
I think that it makes sense that the human mind can't discover all the truth there is out there to know simply through their interactions with the sand in the playground. Relativity took a lifetime of work for Einstein to flesh out and make predictions, and several more lifetimes of physicists going through and plowing through the stars trying to find all the possible tests they could and all those possible tests, gravitational waves, gravitational lensing, the changing of time, essentially, the passage of time for particles traveling at different velocities, every test we could think of, every test has been proven true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in fact, relativity resolved paradoxes. It was a theory that Einstein came up with to resolve
Mercury's precession.
Yeah, right.
The planet Mercury's orbit, it's not a perfect circle. And we understood, because of Newtonian gravity, that Jupiter would be tugging on it, Saturn would be tugging on it. But when all those corrections were plugged in, they didn't take into account everything that we saw. So there was this extra something that was pulling on Mercury that we couldn't find observationally. And it required relativity.
They thought it was another planet, planet Vulcan.
They looked for another planet that we now know definitely isn't there. And it came down to we didn't understand gravity completely. And once we understood gravity, suddenly Mercury's orbit made sense.
This is one of the wonderful things about science, because in many cases, you have to not listen to your intuition. You can't sort of follow your experiences that you had as a child in the playground and what you feel is rational and logical about the universe around you. You have to almost just close your eyes and close your mm-hmm. you know, what you think is right. Your intuition is worthless.
Yeah, because our intuitions are adapted to the environment that we live in, not relativistic speeds, not, you know, subatomic size scale. So there's no reason why our intuition should be adapted to all scales of reality.
We get that a lot as well for like dark matter, dark energy. People will email us and just say, I don't like it. Right? Mm-hmm. That's it.
Yeah.
One of the things that I think people struggle with the most with the whole idea that the speed of light is constant to all observers is that's not what we see when we drive down the highway.
Right.
If I pull out of my driveway and there's a car going down the street at 60 miles per hour, as I accelerate down the road, I'm eventually going to be able to catch up with that car. And if I'm in a little sports car, I might even be able to pass that car. With relativity, if there's a particle of light coming down the street and I pull out of my driveway, no matter how much I accelerate, I'm never going to see myself going the same speed as that particle of light. And that just... it runs against everything our eyes have shown us, but our eyes aren't accurate enough detectors.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to give up at a certain point and trust our instruments.
Right. And just one final point of this, correct me if I'm wrong, but it was Maxwell's equations of electromagnetic propagation that led to the conclusion that C, the speed of light, had to be a constant in all frames of reference, and then followed by the fact that there's light doesn't propagate relative to anything. There is no ether. So basically everything has to measure light to be the same. That was the original paradox that was was a crisis for classical physics, and relativity solved that crisis. It resolved that ultimate paradox, right?
It was Lorentz who started with it, with the Lorentz transformations.
Right.
But it was Einstein who put all the pieces together and defined, here's what it means. Here's a new way of looking at everything. Here's a new way of looking at gravity. He's the one that painted the picture that described what was going on beyond the pure equations.
Right. Lorentz had the fix, but he didn't make that logical leap, say that time and space are relative.
It's sort of like Kepler's equations told us where the planets were, and it took Newton's laws of gravity to explain why they were there.
Right.
It took Einstein to explain why Mercury moves the way it moves.
Well, let's move on to a quick name that logical fallacy. It's been a few weeks since we've done one of these, and this seems to be a popular segment, so I try to squeeze it in whenever I can. I pulled this one off of a comment on our new blog, Science-Based Medicine. The comment section of that has been quite lively. A commenter who goes by the pseudonym of PEC has left this comment recently on one of the blogs. They write, "Mainstream medicine should concentrate on what it does well, emergency surgery, anesthesia, antibiotics, vaccines, diagnostic technology. It should hand over what it does poorly, treatment of heart disease, type 2 diabetes, chronic degenerative diseases, autoimmune diseases, cancer, AIDS, for example, to complementary and alternative medicine, or CAM. There does not have to be any conflict. We don't recommend yoga for someone who just fell off a roof. If CAM is funded and encouraged to advance, it can take over only the areas where mainstream medicine has failed. Mainstream medicine could stop pretending that a cure for cancer is just around the corner. It isn't, not within the current mainstream scientific framework. It could stop prescribing drugs for artery disease that may slow progression and stave off death for a while, but that erode quality of life and well-being. Give CAM a chance and focus on doing what you can be successful at. Aren't you getting tired of failing?
Ooh.
So how many logical fallacies do you detect in that statement? Anyone want to take a stab at it?
How about inconsistency is one fallacy. I guess we haven't really covered that one, but it's inconsistently applying rules to CAM and scientific medicine.
Absolutely, and because you're saying that the commenter is saying that scientific medicine has failed in certain arenas, so therefore we should give CAM a chance. However, CAM has failed spectacularly pretty much in all areas, including the ones that that they are mentioning. So they are applying an inconsistent standard of evidence to so-called complementary and alternative medicine and to mainstream medicine.
Just it fascinates me that, well, yoga isn't close to curing cancer either.
Yeah.
So if mainstream medicine is maybe not close to curing cancer, and we never know when those breakthroughs are going to come, but we're sure really good at treating it.
Mm-hmm.
Why should we believe that alternative medicine is going to get there faster?
Yeah, there's sort of a false dichotomy in there, in that the commenter is characterizing anything less than complete cure as failure. But that doesn't make any sense. That is the unstated major premise of that, is that anything short of a total cure is a total failure. In fact, they even specifically mention that, well, treatments may prolong life for a while. Well, that's pretty damn good. You know, that's pretty much the goal of all of medicine, because guess what? Everyone dies eventually. So life is a fatal disease. So all of medicine just staves off
for
death
now.
For a while. That's actually the outcome that we're looking for.
And the either-or mentality of it.
Yeah.
I don't know any doctor that would turn to a patient and say, oh, you do yoga 20 minutes a day, you do yoga 2 hours a day, and tell you to stop.
Mm-hmm.
No, you should continue to take your heart medicine, your allergy medicine, your whatever medicine. But when it comes to things that encourage physical exercise, yeah, go for it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even consider yoga alternative. I mean, it's just exercise. It depends on what kind of
right.
claims you're making for it. Stretching and exercising, and scientific evidence-based medicine says that's a good thing for you. So it's
yeah.
also, there's some argument through labeling here, and CAM does that quite well.
Right.
You know, considering things that are 100% scientific, like nutrition, as alternative. That's just a branding strategy to try to, again, create another false dichotomy, one between mainstream medicine and one between CAM. That's the big logical fallacy of the entire premise of this comment, that there are these two kinds of things. There's mainstream medicine and alternative medicine, but that's a fiction. It's a false dichotomy. There's just medicine, and either it works or it doesn't work. There's just evidence. You know, there's science. There's one science. There's one reality that it's describing, and this attempt to create two different systems again is really just an attempt to create this double standard, because you can't have a double standard unless you have two different things that you can talk about. So, CAM is really just a fiction invented so that you have an umbrella under which you can promote this double standard. And that's the ultimate logical fallacy lying behind the whole thing.
Well, and he also brings up mythologies. The mythology that we aren't doing well treating AIDS. No, people that have many of the strains of AIDS and receive proper medication, which is extremely expensive and not available everywhere, who take their medicine on time, which is hard to do because it requires strict regimenting, you can get it so that there's no noticeable viral load in the bloodstream.
Right.
I consider that a major win, and I'm not sure how they can label that doing poorly.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a false premise, and they just make that up, you know, really. And it's there's no evidence justification for that whatsoever. Survival times for HIV positive and AIDS patients has steadily increased as our medication cocktail has improved. But there's, you know, this person, you know, and I'm basing this also on the other 50 posts they left on our blog so far, is just ideologically opposed to medicine. you know, to drugs. And that, so this is, there's an ideology behind all of this. So they just make up facts as needed, like when, like we're not successful at treating AIDS, demonstrably false.
But once again, can you you can never make them happy. I mean, if any of these things are proven to be work and are embraced by the scientific medical community, then those things would be the enemy now.
Right. Right. There's also a little bit of a moving goalpost here, again, saying that, well, how do you define success? You know, you can always push back the goalpost and say, well, that's not enough. That's not success yet. So I'm going to call that a failure and in order to argue that we need to do this other thing. And it also is a similar strategy to, say, the creationists. The creationists are always trying to knock down evolution so that what they're promoting is the only thing left. You know, again, it's kind of a false dichotomy where you say it's either A or B, and A has problems, so your only other choice is B. And they're doing the same thing here. It's either mainstream medicine or CAM, and mainstream medicine has all these problems, so we have to turn to CAM. But why? What's the positive argument for this, you know, eclectic collection of implausible and disproven theory modalities and ideas? What's the positive argument for any of it? None.
So perhaps we should only use penicillin sulfa drugs to treat people who don't believe in evolution.
Right. That would work. Well, part of this was just venting because I've been reading this person's comments for a week and it's a little frustrating. All right, let's go on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. And Pamela and Fraser have agreed to play along this week, so they're being good sports. And I'm going to warn you ahead of time, there are no astronomy choices in this week's science fiction.
So I'm out. Forget it.
you're going to be winging it with everybody else. All right. Is everybody ready?
Yeah.
Yep.
Here they are. Number one, conservationists have recently shipped hundreds of specimens of endangered animals to an Arctic preserve where they will be frozen as a hedge against future extinction. Item number two, doctors report a case of a kidney transplant recipient who has been able to live completely off immunosuppressive drugs thanks to a new treatment. And item number three, French scientists have figured out a way to generate useful electricity from rainfall.
Are we allowed to ask for clarification?
Absolutely.
You can, but I am not, obligated to answer.
Don't get your hopes up, Pamela.
Frozen entire animals or DNA?
Pamela, since you're so eager, I'll have you go first.
Oh.
And the answer is entire animals.
Oh, I can't imagine a warehouse big enough to do that. Plus, the Arctic is melting. They won't be safe.
So is that your choice?
My choice is number one is false.
Okay,
fiction.
You're happy with the other two?
Yeah.
Okay. Fraser, why don't you give it a shot?
All right. Useful electricity from rainfall. Isn't that a dam? Right? Isn't that water falls from the sky, goes into a river, it gets dammed, and then
it's already fallen.
Yeah, but like falling rain.
This is not referring to a dam.
Well,
yeah, but it's from rainfall, not from a body of water, regardless of its source.
Individual droplets of rain falling on something. I'm
right. Could it be static electricity of some kind?
I'm going to
Jay. Wait your turn, please, Jay.
Oh. All right, so I'm gonna say that one sounds true because I think that's a dam.
Hey, you're still decelerating the water, and the energy
somehow
can go somewhere.
Yeah, somehow you're slowing it down. You know, a dam of a droplet-sized dam, if need be, but it's still a dam. So I'm buying that.
Okay,
kidney transplant. Sure, I guess because I have no knowledge about that. So that sounds awesome. If true.
Sometimes ignorance is an advantage in this game.
That's all I got. That's all I got. Yeah.
Believe
and
me.
I'm going to have to agree with Pamela on this one. Only that because you said animals, and it makes sense to me to chop little pieces of their DNA and stick it in some kind of refrigerator and move it to the Arctic where it's cheap to run a big fridge. But whole animals, although, you know, it'd be good to have a whole animal because you can't get so much
from
DNA.
Yeah, but we call that tundra. That's where mammoths come from.
Right. Yeah. So I'm gonna go with number one being fiction as well.
Okay, Jay.
Okay, first of all, like I said before, with the rain, I think it has something to do with static electricity. That's my guess, and I think that one is plausible. The kidney transplant, that's one of the ones like I'd love for that to be true. Now, you said, Steve, that they have a new treatment. They're not using immunosuppressive drugs, but they have some other type of treatment.
That's correct.
I don't know about that. And item number one, I have some memory of this, but not enough to know if they're freezing full specimens or DNA, but I'm going to think that that's the twisted one that you created, so I'm going to say that one's the fake.
Okay, Evan?
The rainfall one seems totally plausible. I was probably going to guess the kidney transplant as fiction, but hearing the arguments of what everybody else has had to say, I'm leaning towards the endangered animals one being fiction. Although I wouldn't put it past conservationists. They can get pretty extreme at times, and I wouldn't be totally surprised if there's some modicum of truth to this, but I'll agree with everyone else and say that one is fiction.
So you're going to wimp out and go with the crowd?
Mm-hmm. I sure am.
Okay. Bob?
Three, the generating electricity from rainfall. I could see that perhaps from the kinetic energy of the raindrops. There's been a spate of advances in getting energy from really bizarre sources, and this kind of fits in with that. So I'm buying that. I'm saying that's science. Two, the new drugs to get for a kidney transplant. That's great. That's quite an impressive breakthrough, not needing immunosuppressive drugs. So I'm going to buy that, but only because one is just so outrageous. One has to be fiction. I mean, taking hundreds of endangered animals without – can you imagine the hullabaloo from that, just taking these endangered animals and freezing them? First off, what are you – aren't you dooming to inevitable extinction of their compatriots left behind because now there's less of them? So now they even have less of a chance.
What if they've already died?
They're not killing them.
But still, you're taking the animals. No, you're taking an endangered species and removing one. Like, you might as well just be killing one.
Yeah, Bob, they wait till one's dead.
What?
They wait till it dies. Then they take the corpse. They're not whacking the animal.
That's
on the
not clear.
We need one of these. We need one of these.
Jay, that's not.
It's open.
Jay, that's not clear. That's not clear, Jay.
So you're preserving the DNA of something that didn't make it.
The DNA I could see, but it's not clear that they're dead in any way. All it says here is hundreds of specimens of endangered animals. They could be alive, and I guess they could be dead. But then why would they put it that way? Because all you need is a DNA.
Bob, you are an uber dork, man.
I'm just trying to...
They're dead.
Yeah. Yeah, Bob, they wait till one dies.
So they're freezing roadkill in the Arctic.
Yes, it's dead already.
Endangered roadkill.
Why not just say DNA? Why go this whole... Why
because
say
that's
specimen?
The twist, you jackass. That's the freaking point of the game.
But there's only so much information you can get from a piece of DNA. Sometimes you just got to see the animal, right?
Damn.
Ideally.
Well, I'm going to say that Steve twisted that. They're not taking specimens. They're just taking DNA.
Okay.
There you go.
Let's start with number three with the raindrops. French scientists have figured out a way to generate useful electricity from rainfall, and that one is science.
Sac le fleu.
Although no one hit upon what they're actually doing. No, it's not a dam.
It's not
anybody have any
dam?
Ideas?
Yeah, they're using the rainfall to hit the paddles of a wheel or something.
Static
that's going
electricity,
around.
Man.
Jay, you're the closest. It's not static electricity. It's something called the piezoelectric effect. You know that? Know what that is?
Yeah,
that's what
yeah.
I meant.
Yeah, the generation of electrical current from mechanical force. So what they're doing is using these generators that have a piezoelectric material on it, and the kinetic energy of the raindrop striking the surface produces a little piezoelectric effect, which generates a small amount of electricity.
Didn't I say kinetic energy?
And they've shown, yeah, but the piezoelectric was the piece that everyone was missing.
And we could use that in Vancouver.
They've proven that could generate enough electricity to actually be useful.
So what would they power with that, Steve? Like a French press?
A French fry grill maker or something?
A croissant machine?
So this says when the drops pounded the piezo plastic, they found that it produced between 1 nanojoule and 25 microjoules of energy per drop, depending on the size of the drop. That translates to about 1 microwatt of power for the smallest drops, which is enough to transmit a digital bit of information 10 meters of air.
Hmm.
That's cool. Not a lot of energy, but that's per drop.
Yeah, so when a heavy rainstorm time.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Here in Vancouver, we would rule the world with that kind of electricity.
Yeah, so for those parts of the world that don't have a lot of sunshine, that have a lot of rain and bad weather, this would be a replacement for solar-powered devices. Let's go on to number two. You all also agree that doctors report a case of a kidney transplant recipient who has been able to live completely off immunosuppressive drugs thanks to a new treatment. And that one is also science.
Yeah.
Oh.
This is very impressive.
That's incredible.
Did a clean sweep today.
This is incredibly impressive. This guy's been surviving without immunosuppressive drugs for 2 years. This is a living donor of a kidney, for a brother to a brother that was a very good match. Still, traditionally, this would require long-term immunosuppressive drugs to prevent the recipient's immune system from attacking and rejecting the transplant. You know, immunosuppressive drugs work okay. They don't always succeed. Sometimes they fail. But even when they do succeed, it's a lifelong regimen of medications with a lot of side effects. Mm. So transplant doctors are constantly searching for new and better drugs or new and better ways of preventing rejection. Well, what they did here is they gave a transplant also of blood and I believe of some bone marrow from the donor to the recipient. The goal of that was to try to give the recipient some of the immune cells, some of the immune system of the donor, so that the immune system would think that the kidney that was transplanted into him was his own tissue. It would recognize it as part of his own body, not think that it's foreign and not attack it. That phenomenon is called tolerance. Once they've proven this concept, this hopefully down the road will lead to better techniques for inducing tolerance and may do away entirely with the need for immunosuppression, chronic immunosuppression or long-term immunosuppression in organ recipients. That is quite a breakthrough, actually.
Wow. Stem cells take care of all that.
Maybe. You know, that's obviating the need for transplants. But while we still have to do transplants, this is a big problem. All of this means that, number one, conservationists have recently shipped hundreds of specimens of endangered animals to an Arctic preserve where they will be frozen as a hedge against future extinction, is, in fact, fiction. I did make that one up. You just never can tell what people are going to get hung up on. I didn't think the whole animal bit was going to be that much of a deal breaker for this piece. This is based upon a real news item, though. Are you guys aware of what I derived this from?
Yeah.
It wasn't DNA then?
I mentioned that. I remember reading something about this. I mean, they are collecting DNA, I think other things as well, and they're creating a library, right?
Yeah, it's the...
They're considering putting it on the moon.
Is that right? They're talking about putting it on the moon?
Yeah, that's one of the groups wants to put one on the moon just in case some really terrible calamity happens here on the planet Earth.
That would be cool.
Is it going to be in Finland or something?
This is the Arctic Seed Vault. So this is actually not animals, it's seeds. That was the change.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, so at the end of January, there'll be more than 200,000 crop varieties from Asia, Africa, Latin America, and the Middle East drawn into a massive seed collection and maintained by the Consultative Group on International Agricultural Research. And this will be shipped to a remote island near the Arctic Circle called Svalbard. This is the Svalbard Global Seed Vault. That is a good idea.
Well, from what I've read about that, isn't that in the Arctic, isn't that a backup of a backup? Because there are other seed vaults elsewhere on the planet, and this is just another one that's kind of like the absolute last resort.
Yes, this is a backup of a backup, and the reason for this, or the justification for this, is global warming, that if sea levels rise, these other seed vaults may be at risk, and this is at an altitude and in a location where they feel it will be safe, even with the most pessimistic projections of what global warming is going to do to sea levels, etc.
So, Steve, did you think that we would all think that they were freezing full animals?
I didn't think about it. I didn't think it was that big a deal. You know, you had some rabbits and squirrels and stuff. Who cares?
Well, those aren't endangered.
God. Yeah.
See, I had this vision of an elephant.
Elephants, right.
Gray elephant? White elephant?
Blue whales?
But there is a...
Blue whales. That would be tough.
Oh, God.
Yeah, guys, it's hard to anticipate how people are going to interpret things when they're trying to figure out how viable it is. But that was perfectly reasonable. I mean, things, the fake ones, there has to be something about the fake ones that should give you pause. I mean, otherwise it's not really fair or interesting. So, you know, that was a reasonable thing to come up with to say why it was implausible. It's a lot more plausible to bank a bunch of seeds, you know, because generally they're quite small.
Yeah, you weren't trying to just sucker in the rookies?
Was I trying to sucker you guys in? You never know. Yeah, you know, it's always, it's, of course, it's more sweet if I get you guys to buy something that's totally stupid. But the risk that I take is that
he
you guys
has.
Will sweep me if you figure out, if you see through my ruse.
That's a dangerous game you play.
Everyone did a great job this week. Pamela just sent me this a link to Noah's Cosmic Ark, Preserving DNA on the Moon. That is a cool idea.
But if there is some kind of real catastrophe that happens, I mean, are we going to have the ability to go and retrieve it?
Well, it would probably be the survivors' grandchildren if we're able to rebuild anything.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Or aliens. Aliens checking out our solar system and say, hey, 100 million years ago, there was a civilization here that left these artifacts on their moon. They must have been wiped out by something. That's pretty cool. I imagine that would be rather expensive.
Yeah, we're not doing it yet. It's just in the, this is something we should consider phase.
The backup of the backup of the backup.
Yeah, let's get back to the moon. That's exciting enough for the next 10 years.
By 2020.
Yeah,
is that on schedule for 2020? What do you think about that? Is that going to be on schedule?
I don't think the U.S. is going to be on schedule. But
China.
With the U.S., Russia, China, India, and Japan all at various times making noises that they're going to do it. I think somebody is going to get back there.
Well, there's actually been a recent controversy now where people are trying to pitch the government to go to asteroids instead of the moon.
Why is that? What's the rationale for that?
Well, just that the asteroids are, in some cases, they're in orbits which are very similar to the Earth's orbit. So it actually takes less energy to go to a nearby asteroid than it does to go up to the moon. So nearby asteroids can actually be stepping stones to the moon.
I see. That's interesting.
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm.
And then the moon is a stepping stone to the rest of the solar system because it's mostly out of our gravity well, but it's a large body that we could set up shop on.
Well, and what's cool about asteroids is there's much more easily accessible metals on some of the asteroids than there are on the moon. So the potential to go and start mining operations and using local resources on the asteroid to build things that would allow us to travel further, it exists.
Yeah, although the moon may have water in crater shadows, right?
Exactly. The Aiken's Basin now on the south pole of the moon looks like the perfect place to set up shop for humans. It's relatively protected. It looks like there's probably water. You stick solar panels up out of the crater's shadow. They're in sunlight all the time. Down inside the crater, you're cool all the time.
And relatively safe from radiation, which is pretty important.
I'll build a summer home there.
Jay, do you have a quote for us this week?
Yes, I do. I have a quote from Thomas Huxley. I know this is a scientist that you like, Steve, right?
Oh, yeah. T.H. Huxley. He's the man.
He was an English biologist, and he was also instrumental in getting Darwin's theory of evolution accepted. Is that correct?
Darwin's bulldog, absolutely.
Right. And the quote is, "Science is simply common sense at its best. That is, rigidly accurate in observation and merciless to fallacy in logic." T.H. Huxley!
Thanks, Jay. T.H. Huxley has 1,000 great quotes like that. He's awesome. Well, guys, this has been a lot of fun. I really appreciate you joining us and sticking with us for the whole show.
Well, thanks for having us.
It's been our pleasure.
I've been wanting to crack at that science or fiction for a long time.
and you
good.
Did it. Good job. You're one and one. We keep our statistics, so you're one for one.
Perfect. Perfect. Then I'll never do it again.
Good move. I wish I did that.
Fraser and Pamela, you guys, we were talking about projects that you're working on now, and you're working on something for classrooms.
Right. We have funding from NASA through their Gamma Ray Large Area Survey Telescope, GLASS, which will be hopefully launching this spring. They gave us money to buy recording equipment so that we can get students' questions on audio and answer them on our show. So if there are any teachers out there listening or any students out there listening who can get their teacher involved, we would love to send you recording equipment on loan. We'll pay for everything, get you to record your questions about black holes, about gamma ray bursts, about exploding stars, supernova, all the cool high energy stuff out there, and we'll answer those on our show.
The irony with this, of course, is we get the hardest questions from the kids.
Yeah.
They just ask zingers.
Yeah, because they don't have as many preconceived notions.
And it's wonderful to try and bend our heads around all the things that, you're told your first year of college, well, that can't exist. And you just sort of accept it because it's some gray-haired dude with authority telling you. And it's like, well, why can't it exist? And it's been a lot of fun finding the answers to these students' questions.
Well, good luck with that, and good luck with Astronomy Cast. We'll keep listening. It's one of my favorite podcasts. And hope to have you guys back on sometime.
Anytime.
All right. Thanks for having us.
Yep. Thanks everyone, for joining me.
Thank you.
A good time as always. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.